The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Hey everybody, why don't we get started? Thank you all for coming. My name is Tony Verona. I'm on the faculty here at the Washington College of Law. I teach administrative law and contracts, public law, and media law. So I am a great fan and cheerleader of the fantastic Administrative Law Review and its staff. A special early note of thanks and congratulations to Symposium editor Mel Barras for a truly superb job in putting together what is shaping up to be an excellent symposium. So Snowmageddon notwithstanding, right? We're all here, and it's a great sympo. I have been looking forward to moderating this panel for quite some time. There is quite a bit happening on the communications and media law and regulation front. The FCC, once again, is at the center of a whirlwind of regulatory activity. And we have some interesting things happening in Congress, the FCC, the Justice Department, and other centers of regulatory power. I have asked our three panelists to address a number of questions, and trust me, we do have three panelists. Dan Brenner has sent me four or five emails so far letting me know his progress on Massachusetts Avenue. He was at the FCC at a meeting that perhaps he could tell us about and is on his way. So these are some of the questions that I've asked our panelists over the last week to prepare answers to. First, what would you say were the regulatory challenges in the communications sector that were expected when the Obama administration and the 111th Congress assumed power? Has the Yes, We Can campaign promise for regulatory reforms morphed into Yes, We Might reality? Or, well, we coulda, shoulda malaise? What regulatory changes are underway in the communications and media sector? What is going on in terms of regulatory reform, re-regulation, legislation, etc.? And what is the regulatory outlook? What is on the way? Finally, I asked our panelists to share with us their perspectives and preferences for what is happening regulatorily. In other words, what do they want to see happen in communications regulatory reform in the months and years ahead? We have three phenomenal speakers with us this afternoon to tackle these questions and your questions. We're going to make sure that there's time at the end for questions from all of you. So in alphabetical order, the three speakers are these. First, my old friend Dan Brenner. Dan is a partner in the Communications, Media, and Entertainment Group at Hogan and Hartson, concentrating on matters involving cable operators, programmers, and suppliers with a particular focus on policy, intellectual property, and regulatory matters before the FCC, the U.S. Copyright Office, and Congress. Prior to joining Hogan, Dan headed the Regulatory and Legal Affairs Department of the National Cable and Telecommunications Association, or NCTA, the cable industry's principal trade association, for more than 16 years. Previously, Dan served as the director of the Communications Law Program and member of the faculty at the UCLA School of Law. Dan was also senior legal advisor to Chairman Mark Fowler of the Federal Communications Commission from 1981 to 1986. And although he is much too modest to tell you about this, Dan helped build the framework for the deregulation of television and radio broadcasting, co-authoring with Chairman Fowler a landmark article published in the Texas Law Review whose title says it all, A Marketplace Approach to Broadcast Regulation. A graduate of Stanford University and Stanford Law School, Dan currently serves on the adjunct faculty of Georgetown Law. Harold Feld is the legal director of Public Knowledge, a D.C.-based public interest advocacy organization dedicated to promoting the public interest in access to information. Previously, Harold worked as senior vice president of the Media Access Project, advocating for the public interest in media, telecommunications, and technology policy for almost 10 years with our old friend Gigi Sohn. Prior to joining MAP, Feld was an associate. Harold was an associate at Covington and Burling. He worked on Freedom of Information Act matters, the Privacy Act, and accountability issues at the Department of Energy. Clerked for the D.C. Court of Appeals. Harold also writes Tales of the Sausage Factory, a progressive blog on media and telecom policy, available at www.wetmachine.com. In 2007, Illinois Senator Dick Durbin rightly praised Harold and his blog for, quote, doing a lot of great work helping people understand how FCC decisions affect people and communities on the ground. Chris Riley is policy counsel for Free Press, a national nonpartisan nonprofit organization working to reform the media. Chris advises Free Press on legal matters related to its policy, research, and campaign work, and he represents Free Press on its issues before the FCC and Congress. Prior to joining Free Press, Chris worked as an honors program attorney at the FCC, as a summer associate at Ropes and Gray, and as a legal intern at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Chris earned a JD from Yale and a PhD in computer science from Johns Hopkins. Each of our speakers will have about 18 minutes or so, maybe more if Dan is really stuck in traffic, and then we'll have at least 20 minutes of questions from all of you. So which one of you would like to go first? Chris? Did you want to go first? Did you want to go first?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
I guess you're going to stand up there. Or sit
whatever you'd like.
I think I can handle the sitting. Keep it a little bit informal as we can. Thanks, Professor Verona, for that. It's a pleasure to be here today. As Professor Verona said, I'm a policy counsel at Free Press. It's a nonprofit advocacy organization. We strive to conduct broad campaigns and do a lot of grassroots work. We have hundreds of thousands of activists across the country whom we try to keep informed on the policy activities that we do and whose input we try to get as we shape our policy agenda and as we advocate for specific reform in front of the FCC, Congress, and other federal agencies, including NTIA, the DOJ, the FTC, and others. We work on a very broad range of issues because there really is a lot going on in the communications sector today, whether you're thinking of traditional media from the struggles of the newspaper industry and how we can rethink about journalism in the internet-enabled era, all the way over to the appropriate policies to guide the development of next-generation wireless internet access services. There's really a lot going on right now, and it's an interesting time to be a regulatory attorney and an advocate. I think it's a little early to be issuing any sort of judgment on what the Obama administration has been doing or will do, but I think that they're starting off on the right foot. I want to start out with three present and future themes of the Obama administration in the communication sector and how it's guiding regulatory policy. The first is, especially relative to past administrations, what we see is an active government role to protect consumers, competition, and innovation in the communications sector. This is as a response to what are increasingly consolidated and problematic markets that have resulted from past generations of hands-off deregulatory policies. The Obama administration has made for a long time protection of consumers and protection of these markets part of its platform, and they're continuing to pursue those roads through the FCC and through other federal agencies. The second broad theme, in particular demonstrated at the FCC, is an emphasis on data and analysis in policymaking. They try to really measure twice and cut once in everything that they do. They try to make sure that all of their policy advocacy activities or all of their policymaking is justified by detailed analyses of the market and of the industry and of everything that's going on. And so the result of that is what seem to be delayed but end up being more deliberative and better policies that come out of the federal government. The third theme that I think weaves together a lot of what the Obama administration has been doing in the communication sector is a renewed focus on transparency and democracy. And in two senses I mean this. The first is in the government itself. The FCC's website has undergone and is still in the final stages of a very thorough redesign. And the FCC has been particularly active with Twitter feeds and YouTube channels and Facebook page and so forth. We can pause for a minute. We can bid hi to Dan Brenner. Anyway, so transparency and democracy are one of the third of the three themes characterizing the Obama administration. Also, the government and the FCC in particular has been very good about seeking a broad range of public opinion, not just in filing comments on FCC proceedings, but also in having comments on blog posts at the FCC. The FCC has gone above and beyond to try to make these part of the record, to try to increase the ease for the public to participate in this process. And as our lunch speaker, the President Kerwin, emphasized, this isn't to say that the transparency will automatically encourage or increase public participation or the role in administrative agency processes. Rather, I think that increased public participation in democracy are characteristics of how the FCC wants to continue to reform itself, and transparency is a necessary but not sufficient component of that. But transparency and democracy are keys for the FCC and the Obama communications team more broadly, not just in how the government conducts itself, but also as a substantive target for how to shape the industry and the market and its policymaking. The FCC has opened up a large truth in billing proceeding, which I'll talk about a little bit more later on, and they have at all turns emphasized the importance of having a continuing dialogue between the public and the industry, as well as between the public and the government. So I want to get a little bit into some of the substantive issues that are active now, and there's a very, very long list, so I'm going to hit on a few of the major ones, and my apologies if I don't get to something that you've been paying particular attention to. I think the first and foremost issue that everybody thinks about when they think about Obama and the communication sector right now is probably still net neutrality. Net neutrality or network neutrality or the open internet proceeding or whatever you want to call it is an issue that is not new to the Obama administration, not by a long shot. It started many years ago, and I think one of the key advances, although it wasn't the first step, but one of the key early steps towards getting open internet policies as part of the communications legal and regulatory framework started in 2005 when the Federal Communications Commission issued its internet policy statement. The FCC's Internet Policy Statement in 2005 set out four principles to establish consumer rights of access to content, applications, and services on the Internet through the device of their choice and with benefits of competition among content, applications, and services. The issue became even more high profile in 2007 to 2008 with some activity under the past FCC Chairman Kevin Martin. In 2007, the FCC put out a broad notice of inquiry on broadband industry practices, seeking to identify what the network operators were really doing and how it was violating the principles that the FCC had laid out. And in 2008, the FCC successfully prosecuted a complaint against Comcast, the big cable company, for behavior that involved, depending on who you're talking to, blocking or at least severely degrading the use of BitTorrent and some other applications on internet access services. So we've seen a rich history already with open internet, so it's little surprise that even though the Comcast complaint is embroiled in some contentious court review, the Obama administration is still moving forward with it. In fact, open internet policies were one of the most important components of President Obama's technology policy as he was campaigning. And the current FCC Chairman, Julius Genachowski, played a very large role in shaping President Obama's technology portfolio. Chairman Genachowski has followed President Obama's support for this issue throughout his time in office, even though he hasn't been in there very long just yet. So it, I think, is not at all a surprise to anyone in this sector that the FCC is pursuing open internet policies. The FCC is also not the only federal agency taking a role in this. In the broadband stimulus process, the NTIA, National Techno—I don't even remember what NTIA stands for. National Telecommunications and Information Administration. In the NTIA, when they set out rules for the applicants for grantees for the $7.2 billion set aside for broadband money, non-discrimination was one of the requirements that they attached to their portion. They didn't get the full $7.2 billion. But non-discrimination is an issue not just at the FCC, but also at NTIA and at other federal government agencies as well. I think it's one of the foremost active issues in this space right now. And in October 2009, the most recent sort of broad move on this, the FCC moved forward with a notice of proposed rulemaking to propose open internet rules. Comments are filed on that in January, and reply comments are due to be filed in March. So, in other words, we have a long history to this proceeding. It continues to proceed ahead at a fairly rapid pace, although the final timing is, as always, highly uncertain. I don't want to get too much into the substance of this because we could be arguing all day, but the basic substance at issue here is an encapsulation of the four principles of 2005 into rules, as well as two additional rules, one on non-discrimination in the management of internet traffic, subject to an explicit exemption for reasonable network management. And the other is a rule on transparency. There's one of those three key themes again. Transparency by the internet service providers in their management of network traffic. And all of these rules, of course, have different meanings depending on who you talk to. But I'm going to try to stay away from some of that for now. The Free Press take on this, since one of the questions that I was asked to respond to was, what do you feel? What do you expect? What do you want out of this process? Free Press, along with Public Knowledge, actually, we've been the leading organization supporting this process and supporting open internet policy for several years now. In our January comments at the FCC, we offered some fairly detailed solutions to the open and still debated issues in this proceeding, as well as our analysis of the impact of the rules on the broadband market. Again, issues for which many parties will still disagree. But we're keeping an eye on this. We're optimistic that it's moving forward as it is, and we're doing what we can to achieve what we feel is the best outcome. I want to jump from that to the broadband plan, which I referenced earlier. The background for this is, of course, part of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, the giant economic stimulus package, part of which allocated $7.2 billion, part through the NTIA and part through the Department of Agriculture's Rural Utilities Service, to go to funding broadband and broadband-related projects throughout the country. And part of this bill asked the FCC to set out a national broadband plan to sort of set a path forward for the federal government in guiding the broadband markets to sort of enter the next generation. This has been a long and complicated process at the FCC, but it's moving ahead, and there are a lot of people doing a lot of work on it. There have been 39, public notices as part of this proceeding with thousands of comments filed. This is a very, very active process with a lot of input from a lot of different people and interest groups. Now, to get back to Professor Verona's comments, I don't think anybody would have said in 2008 that we expected the FCC to devote so much of its resources and attention onto developing a national broadband plan. That having been said, everyone in 2008 in the communication sector said that we needed to, because we don't have, did not have, do not yet have a guiding plan for how we are to shape the broadband and telecommunications markets in this country going forward. And yet we're operating in an environment where these markets and the technologies that are in use are completely different than anything we've been dealing with ever in our history. So the need for a broadband plan has been very clear. What that plan will look like, it's hard to say. Free Press has actually filed a couple of different comments where we have called for the report to be substantially more aggressive than it probably will end up being. We've asked for very aspirational goals. We want the FCC to set out very strong benchmarks. We want high-speed internet for a wide portion of this country. We want to make sure that this plan does more than just sort of acknowledging what's been happening. We want it to set out a bold vision for where we want to go down the road and also how we will get there. We've also called for a lot of other policy changes to be made in the course of this plan, including an overhaul of the universal service regime, a broadband lifeline equivalent, more middle-mile public investment, user training programs, more detailed market analyses, and aggressive competition policy moves to improve the state of the market if it doesn't meet specific triggers, and a number of other things that I won't go into in detail. So a lot of work continues on this. A lot of different interest groups are participating in this. The FCC is spending a substantial amount of resources on it, and it's definitely, along with the open internet proceeding, one of the most important things to pay attention to right now in the FCC space and in the communication sector more broadly. I want to cover a couple more issues as quickly as I can to leave some time for other people to talk. One is on disclosure. Again, this is back to that third theme that I identified at the beginning. Transparency and disclosure is an important part of making sure that we get the right regulatory policy is to have an ongoing public role in this process. The disclosure issues that the FCC generally center around or are derived from, rather, the FCC's history of truth in billing policies. The FCC has spent many years looking at the bills that you get for your phone services and your cable services and making sure that these contain a lot of information about what fees you're paying and why, so that you're not sort of suckered into paying more than you should be. And an outgrowth of these under the Obama FCC and Chairman Janikowski has been a sort of expanded focus on the customer more broadly. There's theme number one, by the way, for those of you taking notes. An expanded focus on the consumer more broadly, on consumer protections. And what information do you as a consumer have when you go in to get a cell phone or an internet access service? Do you have the information that you need to understand what you're getting? Do you have all of the information about not just minor fees, but overage fees that could hit you? For example, wireless service providers often bury in fine print that if you have a laptop and a netbook, a little USB card or something that you stick into the side, if you use more than your designated cap for that month, you can be charged a fee that ranges anywhere from $200 to $500 per gigabyte of data usage over that, so that if you double the 5 gigabytes that they give you as sort of a base usage amount, if you just use 10, suddenly your wireless data bill goes from being $60 a month or $30 a month to being $5,000 a month. And that's not an exaggeration. That actually happens. So we've been hitting hard on this issue, and the FCC has been taking a lot of look at it as well. They have an open proceeding looking at these practices, and they've also sent out a series of letters. This is another topic that was discussed at the luncheon and probably is true across the administration. Even where rulemaking proceedings take a long time and invite a lot of political controversy, the Obama FCC has been quick to, relatively quick to, send out targeted, pointed letters to the market to say, here's something that's going on. We're a little concerned about it. Tell us more about this. To invite the industry to give more information about what's going on as maybe a prelude to rulemaking, maybe not, maybe just a signal to the market to try to get it to correct itself a little bit without having to go into all of the details of rulemaking. So we've been seeing that with early termination fees and with some other issues in this space. jumping to is this an expected development? I don't know. I think certainly updating the FCC's website was expected because the thing is a decade old. And largely, increased emphasis on public participation and transparency is always expected and never actually really goes as far as it should. And I wouldn't be surprised if this goes this way, too. We've been calling, along with other public interest organizations, for a lot of different regulatory reforms to not just hope that disclosure gets better, but to force disclosure to get better. We're hoping for a Schumer box style. Schumer box is from Senator Chuck Schumer. It's a little box of information that you get on your credit cards. When they mail you an unsolicited credit card offer, it has this box with the APR and all this other information laid out through it. And we've been calling for something similar to this for your wireless and your internet access services in particular, something that lays out in detail all of the different fees associated with this service, all the different performance expectations. And we've also been calling for a two-tiered disclosure rule for what practices the providers engage in that discriminate or in some way interfere with your use of the internet. But I won't get too much into the details of that. This disclosure is also tied in with something that the FCC has been taking a broader look at our encouragement and ours and public knowledge's and many other groups, which is wireless competition. Wireless markets are very interesting right now. They're undergoing a lot of technological change, and a lot more people are suddenly becoming avid wireless users as they get iPhones and Android phones and everything else and start using a lot of wireless internet access. So the FCC is finally no longer rubber stamping the wireless market as being a competitive enterprise and is starting to take a detailed look at some of the things that make it hard for you to switch a wireless carrier once you're locked into one. And as many of you will know, there are a lot of things that make it hard for you to switch. Once you get your iPhone on AT&T, you're stuck for a couple of years, and even when you want to leave, you have to throw away your iPhone and get a new device. So I'm hopeful that the FCC will continue what has thus far been a pretty strong track on these issues. And the final issue that I want to touch on briefly before I pass it over to Harold is perhaps one of the most newsworthy. And that's the proposed, depending on what stage you want to consider it to be, the proposed merger between Comcast and NBC. Comcast and NBC have entered into a deal to make NBC a 51% owned by Comcast with a path towards 100% ownership over the course of the next 4 or 5 years, depending on certain conditions. Obviously, a merger between Comcast and NBC would be epic, absolutely epic. And it's raising broad concerns throughout the communications sector from many people in the government, many in the public interest community, and also many of Comcast and NBC's competitors. this merger has both horizontal and vertical concerns. On the horizontal side, the merger involves two companies, both of which own a lot of cable networks. So then you're going to have one company that owns a lot of cable networks and can leverage its control over all of these to insist on bundle deals and a lot of other things that could pose a problem. This is also a horizontal merger on the distribution side. NBC owns a 30% stake in Hulu, which could eventually serve as a competitor to Comcast cable TV business. Comcast is also entering into this TV Everywhere idea where Comcast, through its recently rebranded Xfinity service, will offer access to its cable television channels to internet users over the internet, provided you subscribe to Comcast Internet and also Comcast television service. They're talking about expanding that to the point where you wouldn't actually need Comcast Internet service, but still, the idea of the TV Everywhere development is that you cannot get internet cable unless you also pay for traditional cable, and that's something that is threatening to undermine the competition that Hulu could eventually offer. There are also vertical problems that arise as part of this deal. Comcast is the largest cable TV company. It's also the largest residential fixed ISP company. And NBC is an invaluable and large content company. So by merging these two together, the cable company suddenly will have the power to potentially extract anti-competitive fees from other cable TV providers and to stifle any possibility of internet-delivered competitors to its own cable television service. So there are a lot of problems that arise with this deal. And we could also see, if it is approved, we could see it leading towards other similarly epic mergers in the future and ever more consolidation within this industry. So as to whether this was expected, I think they probably should have tried it a couple years ago. They might have found easier sailing for it. But consolidation is the trend that this sector has been on for a long time. So I think it's expected. I'm not at all surprised. I hope it gets rejected, plain and simple. I think this would be a bad thing for this sector, and we've been fighting hard to have it rejected. That having been said, if it's not, there are some strong protections that could ameliorate a lot of the potential harms, including ensured availability of Comcast NBC content for other providers at reasonable rates, ensuring unaffiliated programming get carriage on Comcast systems, ensuring the availability of third-party content and Comcast NBC content on online internet-delivered video. But I'd really like to see it stopped. I think that's all I've got.
That's great. Thank you very much, Chris. That's very, very good.
If you don't mind, I am going to stand up a bit.
Occasionally taught at law school, and so I can't get out of the habit of standing up here. But all right, first of all, I want to thank everybody here and for having this panel on communications law. The most important question we ask initially is, why do we care? There's a lot of other areas of administrative law that could be studied. Financial was kind of a gimme based on the fact that we either narrowly escaped or have only temporarily averted or have walked away from the abyss of a Great Depression-like catastrophe. But why do we care enough about communications here and now? And I would say the answer to that lies to some degree in the fact that a great number of you have your laptops up, you're doing whatever it is you're doing, and those of you that aren't, if you're in classes, the most common complaint from professors is everybody's texting and surfing and using their phone, so even if you shut off the Wi-Fi, it doesn't help. It touches all of our lives in every single way these days. So communications has become one of the most critical aspects of our economy. It's become one of the most critical aspects of our competitive future. It's become one of the most critical aspects of our roles of political engagement, as what's been going on in Iran proves. So it's important. The expectations for the Obama administration coming in were very high in this regard, because unlike the Bush administration, which frankly didn't have a clue about telecommunications or media or why it was important, the NTIA, which Chris had mentioned, had really just sort of ceased having any significant impact anywhere. The FCC, however, enjoyed a happy life of its own under two fairly independent-minded chairs. But that was okay, because the Bush administration didn't have an administration-wide policy on communication in the same way that it had on some of the other aspects of its tenure. This administration, there was a tremendous expectation. You know, Obama gets it. He's the first president who won't give up his BlackBerry. He does stuff on YouTube. You know, all of the things that everybody heard tons about in 2008 and still do. And with some justification. There are not a lot of presidents who, when doing an interview on YouTube, would have taken a question about network neutrality or given the very definitive answer that he gave. So clearly this is an administration that cares, and they followed it up by appointing a lot of people who care with a lot of background that care. So naturally, the first thing I'm going to talk about is what were the process expectations, because when you are a lawyer, there is nothing more exciting in the whole wide world than administrative process. More to the point, actually, as I tell everybody who I teach about this, process matters, because processes determine outcomes. They really do. And if you are actually practicing this stuff for a living, knowing how the machinery works is critically important to getting the results you want. By contrast, not understanding how the process works and how changes in processes matter means that you are going to perpetually wonder why you are not able to get what your client wants. So what were the process expectations? Well, the FCC was regarded as a pretty dysfunctional agency when the Obama people came in, and NTIA had been reduced to practical non-existence except for the DTV converter coupon program. The notion was, as with everything, more open and transparent. In fact, it became a cliche around the FCC to say open, transparent, data-driven, preferably all in one sentence or all in one breath. There was expected to be a shift along the lines that Cass Sunstein outlined earlier today in the keynote of how the FCC would analyze the data it takes in that form the basis of its decisions. This was a move away from sort of classic or neoclassic University of Chicago economics school thought to much more behavioral orientation, a desire for actual empirical evidence, which had been sadly missing in this arena for the last 8 years, and which the D.C. Circuit still regards as optional, greater reliance on bureaus rather than centralizing all decisions in the chairman's office, which had been a hallmark of the Kevin Martin administration, greater interagency cooperation, which was a tremendous, would be a tremendous change from the Bush administration, where each agency essentially controlled its own fife. Where to the extent there was ever any kind of interagency discussion, it was more confrontational than cooperative. And finally, there was some expectation for a reinvigorated NTIA, although nobody knew exactly what that was likely to mean until passage of the stimulus with the national broadband stimulus and the national broadband plan and mapping components. In terms of substance, what was in broadband, spectrum, consumer protection, and what we would call pro-competitive regulation. The notion that the Bush administration had was that all regulation is, you know, bad, it imposes cost, it never creates jobs, everything you've ever heard if you watch Fox News, and therefore the best thing to do is to eliminate regulation. Occasionally you might come up with something you absolutely needed, but otherwise, you know, the best that the Bush administration had to do was, you know, you treat it like radioactives and chemotherapy. It's nasty, dangerous, poisonous stuff, but occasionally you have to give it to people to keep them from something worse. The expectation for the Obama administration was a more sophisticated approach. The idea that, you know, regulation can serve to stimulate competition, that it has an important role in protecting consumers, that competition itself is not necessarily sufficient to achieve our ends, and that the notion of having an industrial policy is not a dirty and shameful thing that brings you close to socialist statism. The notion that goes back to kind of the core of the Communications Act and the public interest standard, that yes, there is supposed to be an expert agency that is kind of generally encouraging and guiding and shepherding industry towards general improvements around services, towards innovation and new technologies, and that regulation or information gathering by the agency can assist that. That was an expected basis for how this FCC was going to act. What was going to be out? All old media. Nobody cared about television anymore, except once we got done with the DTV conversion. Nobody cares about radio anymore. The 2010 quadrennial ownership review, which used to be the annual, used to be two-year, now it's four-year review of ownership regulations, used to be a huge deal. Now people don't even care that we're into 2010 and we haven't even started this process yet and nobody knows when we're going to. So what actually happened? Well, we got off to something of a slow start. Part of that was the fact that it took a very long time to get the FCC in place. It was not until the August meeting, I believe, that we actually had all five commissioners at the FCC assembled. That meant that for more than half the year, we were operating with an acting chairman and with a three-member commission, so it was very hard to get anything but DTV transition done. No one wants to, when they're in the caretaker mode, start something dramatic. At NTIA, it took until May to get Larry Strickling in. The result of all of this was that we had a lot of focus on the National Broadband Plan because that was big, that was going to create jobs, and that had deadlines. That included both a broadband map component, because despite the fact that broadband is critical infrastructure for our country, we have literally no solid idea about how it actually works, where the lines are, where the capacity is. We have anecdotal stories. We have stuff that providers choose to share with us, and we have very high-level data. But for something which is this critical to our economy, we really don't know jack about it, which should scare you. We had a lot of notices of inquiry, which reflected the change in philosophy. They were really big. They asked lots of good questions. They looked at a lot of stuff that were very complicated. We had lots of public notices around the National Broadband Plan and the formulation of the National Broadband Plan. We did a lot of research. We submitted a lot of comments, and not a lot actually happened at the FCC, leading some of us to ask, does data-driven actually go anywhere? Because it seemed like the FCC was sort of stuck shifting gears. One of the other unfortunate outcomes of this was that the shifting of work down to the bureaus, the ramp-up that was necessary. We discovered just how thoroughly decimated the Bureau, the FCC and NTIA had become. I do have some sympathy for them because they had to ramp up enormously to do the National Broadband Plan and what was expected of them with no guide for how to achieve a project of this magnitude. It's really difficult to sit here and understand. You'd think giving away $7.2 billion would be easy, but the fact is when you are told to do it in this really smart, intelligent fashion, to distribute it around the country, to take on a job with $7.2 billion that everybody agrees probably needs $50 to $100 billion, and under all manner of accountability, while encouraging competition and, you know, laundry list of things you're supposed to do, it's hard. Not made easier by the fact that they were taking over an agency where anybody who survived basically through 8 years of the Bush administration either had been beaten into utter submission or was not somebody I'd want working on this plan. So all of that said, one good thing that came out of this was there was a lot of focus on e-government, because that they could do very quickly. And I do not underestimate that. I think that is actually very important. I think that while it is true that 95 to 99% of the time nobody cares about the FCC's tweets or blogs or any of those things or the ability to access them that way, the 1% of time that it matters, it's really, really important and you want it there. And even the remaining 99 or 95 or however much percentage of the time, it still does good for those of us who are trying to follow this stuff. So I don't underestimate the e-government. I think it's important. I think it's already having positive effects. The other thing is that we are now actually seeing the FCC starting to get some stuff done. A lot of it is very technical, very geeky, and very unsexy, but it's good and it's substantive, which does bring me to my predictions of what are we going to likely to see going forward. I think, as I said, we are going to continue to see the agency, both NTIA and the FCC, pursue the transparency and open government. I think there is genuine effort there to try to take stuff into account. I think there are practical problems that need to be worked out, but I think that there is a lot of genuine intent to do so. I believe that we are going to see continued significant agency coordination and cooperation as a result of the National Broadband Plan, not just with NTIA and the FCC, but with other agencies as well, because I believe there's been a recognition that's been created by in this administration that to achieve the goals that we want in the National Broadband Plan of near 100% coverage and high levels of adoption that we feel are necessary to achieve our national goals, that we're going to see that, and that that's a government-wide effort, and it's not something you have to go to Congress to get, which is critically important. I think there is going to be a question. I think we are going to see a continued interest in research and new approaches that we've seen, an emphasis on data gathering, but I also think that there are a lot of challenges that we will see as the agencies start to pry into data that the carriers, frankly, do not want to provide. You know, there will be a lot of questions of what happens when carriers just say, we're not going to provide the information that you all want to have from us, whether or not you have the legal authority to compel us. Substantively, spectrum is going to be huge here. I'm not sure how many people here follow spectrum. Spectrum is, there's a lot of discussion about do we have access to enough wireless? Do we are we in a spectrum crisis? Are iPhones going to bring down the phone network? You know, a lot of it is kind of the usual crap, but the fact is that there is kind of a general consensus that we need to change the way we're doing business with wireless, kind of in the same way that 10 years ago there was a consensus that we needed to change the way we were doing business around energy consumption. Because if we don't, then we are going to not be able to sustain our rising demand. So, of course, we're also at the stage where everybody believes everybody else ought to change in order to make sure that I have the access that I want. So we will see a lot of action in this area. It's not clear yet what that will be. In addition, there's a wild card that the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, wants to find federal spectrum that the federal government has for agency use to auction, because that can raise many billions of dollars in theory. There's a lot of questions about that because federal agencies like Department of Homeland Security and the FAA use that to do things from keeping planes from falling out of the sky, so there's some tension between those goals. In broadband, we are going to see a lot of action around adoption, which has not traditionally been an FCC priority, but is part of a new, what we may call, ecology approach that comes out of the National Broadband Plan. There's a lot of interest in how do you modify universal service, how do you take the program that we have called E-Rate that puts internet connections in every school and make that something that helps to spread broadband adoption and education, not just to people in school, but to people in their apartments or homes where they don't necessarily have internet access, either because they don't have it available to them, they can't afford it, or they don't understand why it would be valuable to them. We are going to continue to see some efforts at what we would call pro-competition regulation. People who follow this may have noticed that there is some talk about whether they're going to open up fiber lines to provide broadband to business. There is effort around the consumer protection stuff, as Chris mentioned, on the open internet and on in other areas. My personal feeling is that this the geekier the better for the success in this administration, which is the more it's something like special access, which I'm willing to bet most people here haven't heard of, and relates to or spectrum sharing and all of these things that don't grab headlines and that don't attract, you know, Tea Party emails about how it's the fairness doctrine for spectrum if we go to opportunistic sharing, you know, that's not going to happen. So the FCC is going to succeed fairly well on that front, I think. When it comes to network neutrality and other things, where it is possible for providers to plug into, you know, and it's sort of been an interesting competition because it used to be progressives own the internet in this regard, and we could plug into all of the anger about Bush, and all you had to know was that, you know, Fox and Comcast, you know, which suppressed information about the war in Iraq, you know, were against network neutrality, and that was good for 500,000 emails from Common Cause and, you know, those organizations. Now it's kind of the reverse, you know. All it takes is a, you know, Rush Limbaugh to say network neutrality is the fairness doctrine of the Internet, and you get 10,000 people, you know, emailing the FCC that, you know, they think it's a bad idea. So I think that there's going to be much more resistance on some of the headliner issues and a lot of progress on the geeky stuff. I will add just two things really quick. One is the cable surprise. The fact is that everybody thought the cable stuff was dead. Turns out not so much. Video remains critically important to what people want. People want to have that living room of the future that we've seen advertised for 10 years where one device lets you pull stuff from, you know, online and see it on your TV and you can surf, you know, the web as easily as you can surf, you know, on your channels, on your big screen TV. So a whole bunch of proceedings around open video and set-top boxes, which everybody thought were pretty moribund, have suddenly become interesting. The NBC Comcast merger, of course, stirs up a lot of issues, including very traditional cable issues. Finally, there is the worry about what we call the Federal Copyright Commission. Democrats are much closer to Hollywood than Republicans are. The downside of that is that the MPAA and others would cheerfully, you know, make sure that a mistake like the Internet never happened again if they could because of the disruptive influence it has on their business models. Now, you know, it's true, you do see a lot of pirated stuff out there, but the fact is that most of the reactions to piracy that have been urged on the FCC don't really have a lot to do with piracy, and there isn't a lot of evidence that they would be effective in preventing piracy. But the FCC is increasingly, as part of the National Broadband Plan and elsewhere, being urged to take more of an active role in either actively policing the Internet with regard to copyright enforcement or to create safe harbors so that providers can kick people off the Internet more easily or read through what you're downloading just to make sure that you bought it legally and all of these other things. And whereas previous FCCs would have said that's absurd, of course that's not something that we would ever permit. This FCC is unfortunately much more receptive to that. As for what I would like to see, I'll conclude with a little process wish. Because again, you know, process is important and data is important. The FCC has the power to compel true and accurate information. It has the power to make that information available in the public record. It has the power to shield people who are afraid of reprisals from industry, which is a huge problem of getting people to come forward, because you have a lot of small providers or small businesses who depend, you know, entirely on the Quest special access line in their town, who are not going to come forward and say Quest is really obnoxious about the terms that they impose on us, because they know that Quest will pull the plug on them, and history shows that the FCC is not very good at protecting people who come forward. So my personal thing that I would really like to see more than anything else is for the FCC to wake up to the fact that under the Communications Act, it has much greater power to actually compel truthful and accurate reports from those that it regulates on a variety of issues and subjects pertinent to the hot issues in regulation, and that it has authority to protect those who come forward, and that it should do so. Thank you.
Thank you. Dan?
Sorry to run you.
No, it's perfect. And then we'll have time for questions.
Okay. Actually, I've become a big regulator in the last hour of my life. I believe that snow removal regulation in the district requires federal action today.
Here, here.
To give you some idea of how serious I take this vow, after a certain amount of swearing in an email to Professor Verona, who blushes at really at the sign of a hello, the see? Blushing. I don't even have to get to the big words. I dialed 911 because apparently in this city, snow removal is administered not by any government official, but by whoever runs the dump truck and can block Mass Avenue when that dump truck driver, whether there's a policeman or not, decides the traffic will be blocked. I apologize for missing part of apparently Chris's unending presentation. So I think what I will do now. So I did catch enough to really see Avatar in between the breaths. But let me, did you tell him I did stand-up? No, thank you, Tony. Thank you, Tony. Don't get embarrassed. So I got a couple points. And actually, I listened to, it's unbelievable that I would agree with as much of what Harold said as I do, but it was quite a bit of
David NCTA was good for you.
No, it wasn't that so much. It was... But I apologize, Chris, if I repeat some of the things you said, but that may be impossible. Obviously the communication policy in ad law is tied to the election, and Obama was, as I think both speakers very fairly presented, the internet president. He got his campaign in gear through the internet. He raised a lot of money through the internet. The chairman of the FCC helped him with that process. And so he was, I think he understands it better than really we've had in a very long time. President Reagan was probably the last president who knew something about communication because he'd been the head of the Screen Actors and had worked as a producer and involved in Hollywood governance. But this president knows a lot. I think his utterances on network neutrality are Delphic, are confusing. I don't know that he always can tell you exactly what he means by network neutrality. And this has been a problem in the debate because we talk a lot about it, but everybody has a slightly different take on what those words mean. But the people who are attracted to the administration, including guys like Cass Sunstein, who's kind of a giant in the academic world, but he took a job which is not one that you think would be a resume builder. But his title's not real glamorous, but it's very influential in the way that government actually gets done. One of the fights I had with Professor Feld at one point was over a thing called leased access, and among the places that we did battle was the Office of Management and Budget, and the way in which the government wrote the rules that Harold helped with a fair amount, and we convinced the Office of Management and Budget that the rules didn't comply with the APA. So some of this stuff that you study actually winds up being a sucker punch that works when you're trying to do government work. We also happened to get a stay from the Court of Appeals to give you some idea of how bad the rules were. But we did use process in that instance. But so who gets attracted to the Obama administration? I mean, people who were Reaganites, and you can look it up on Google. I have $1,000 into the Obama for President Fund. I'm a registered Democrat, but I worked in the Reagan administration at a time when the FCC was not so partisan, when you could be actually. I worked both for the Democratic chairman, Charlie Ferris, and the Republican chairman, Mark Fowler. A lot of people I met in the Reagan administration were true believers. I think the Bush administration typical types, you may not have a typical type, but they were often very politically motivated. Certainly Kevin Martin got his job because he was general counsel of the Bush for President, and he quit. He's a Harvard-trained lawyer who quit his job on K Street, went down to Austin, took his chances with the Bush campaign, which wasn't obvious that Bush was going to be the nominee. So in some ways, he deserved, in a way, some of the spoils of that, just like Julius, put his time in and raised a lot of money for President Obama. But the people who are in it now, I think, are people who are either at a point in their career where they say, I may never get a chance to serve in government again. I want to serve. I believe in the role of government. I need to find a way to express that. And you see a lot of very quality people come into the FCC. The bureau chiefs, who were really nudniks in the because it was such a chairman-centric agency under Chairman Martin, the bureau chiefs didn't have a lot of authority. They were really there to to help prepare items that the chairman directed. The bureau chiefs you're seeing now are people who have a lot of brains, a lot of authority. One's an ex-partner of Wilmer Cutler. You know, you're not talking about folks who are trying to work their way up through the government ranks. So it's a very impressive group that's been assembled there, a lot of smarts. But as much as they've upgraded, I think, and while they have upgraded the website and the process, I think you have to realize that the Internet has affected administrative law profoundly in the sense that the people who make decisions, let's put it this way. Most decision makers, and I sat in the chairman's office for 7 years, so I did watch two different presidentially appointed chairmen consider the record. I don't think they ever considered the record. I don't think they ever read the record. There's not time for it. So the work I get to do in private practice or filing comments do have an influence on bureau people, but most commissioners and their legal advisors simply don't have time to read them unless they're pointed to three or four pages and an executive summary. What do they read? What does influence the record? Well, you'd hope, as Harold said, to have it more on the record, but in fact things like communications daily, telecommunications reports daily, and blogs that are read by decision makers, those have a lot of influence. So getting a story in telecommunications reports or communications daily can be as significant as filing a very complete filing. It may lead people to read the filing, which is awfully important too, but you don't want to underestimate these informal ways in which policymakers get intelligence. And of course, meeting people they trust. If Harold and Chris have relationships with, and I think both of those public interest organizations have very good relationships with the chairman's office, they're going to get a listen to. I'm not so sure that all of industry has as good a set of relationships with those people as public interest groups. And let me say a word about the public interest bar, because when I came out of law school, when I was sitting in those seats in the mid-70s, I thought that's what I would wind up doing. But there was no public knowledge. There was no free press. There was very little funding for what public interest behavior went on in communications. So in a way, we're very lucky to have these organizations as a ballast, as a way for information. Now, whether they do a great job or not, you can judge by what they file, what they say, and what they do. But the idea of having somebody other than simply for-pay advocates at the FCC, I think, is a very healthy part of the process. A couple other points I want to make, and several have been made by the other speakers, so I don't want to repeat, but one thing you're seeing is a blurring of the agencies. The Federal Trade Commission and the Federal Communication Commission, I think, are getting into each other's knitting. So when as Chris mentioned, the Federal Communications Commission is having a truth in billing procedure, for goodness sakes, this has been the long-standing jurisdiction of the Federal Trade Commission. That's really what that's in their DNA. But the FCC is getting into that. Of course, the FTC wants to be part of the network neutrality debate. So the current chairman of the FTC said that the report that they did 2 years ago is stale and they need to take a fresher look. Both sides want to get into privacy. So you almost get the feeling that there's a kind of a competition for getting the attention of the communications and public and the communications and information industry before each of the agencies. NTIA is not to be dismissed either. They had this very large stimulus plan program to administer. We're now almost at the end of 2009. One would have hoped stimulus money would all be gone by now so that we would actually have stimulated the economy, and not too much of it has gone out. And that's very disappointing in terms of the stimulus part of what the plan was. I might also note that $7.2 billion, which is a lot of money, at least for most law students in terms of their loans, and some of you come out with that, the industry itself spends about 10 times that much, maybe even 12 times that much every year as part of their capital expenditure. So the ability of this money to actually make a difference in terms of the investment in the Internet is not nearly as significant as what was hoped for, which was stimulating the economy, which really hasn't occurred so much. One of the other interesting things that's developing is that while you have the public interest bar very influential on the network neutrality docket, I don't think it would be where it is if it wasn't for Chris's organization. You also see a little bit of pullback from organizations that typically align with public interest groups. A lot of minority groups, when I say minority groups representing ethnic, racial minorities, are saying, wait a minute. Maybe the view of the public public interest community that favors network neutrality is not going to help people who can't afford broadband today. So one of the issues that's come up is some minority groups have filed opposing what some of the public interest groups have said. In the past, these groups were always in the same ballpark on things like ownership, broadcasting. These tended to be very, very sympathetic entities. So if you're the chairman of the FCC, you don't have a monolithic view of what the public interest, besides the private interest advocates, are presenting. Plus, you have to deal with Congress. We've talked a lot about the administration, but no federal agency, I shouldn't say no federal agency, but certainly this federal agency, the FCC, is a creature of Congress. Realize that tomorrow, on the 17th of February, Congress could eliminate the FCC. It was just created to fulfill the purposes that were established, and if the commission, and if the FCC completes those purposes, or the Congress says, we don't need you anymore, goodbye. There actually, in my lifetime, some federal agencies have disappeared. The Civil Aeronautics Board disappeared. The Copyright Royalty Tribunal disappeared. So it's not as if federal agencies are there perpetually, and as we're seeing with the strange birth pangs of a federal consumer finance protection agency, that it's pretty hard to get them actually started. And I can remember 12 or 15 years ago when Ralph Nader advocated for a general consumer protection agency. And there was a lot of debate and legislation about that, never happened. So I'm not saying the FCC is going away, but I think you have to realize that Congress can change its scope and can certainly influence what its people, what its members can do. Just look at what happened in the network neutrality debate so far. There was reportedly a very, very, an even more strongly worded notice of proposed rulemaking. I think it's fair to say, Chris, that the Free Press would have enjoyed an even more robust or more activist notice in this. But the notice that actually came out was, from all press accounts, muted. Why? A lot of discussions went on. 70-plus members of Blue Dog Democrats wrote to the chairman of the FCC saying, we're not so sure this is such a hot idea. Other strong Democrats came out the other way. Republicans had problems with it from the get-go. But all of this means that Congress plays an enormous role in what ultimately comes out of the FCC. And it's to think that it's based on the administrative record alone would be, I think, misguided. Let me just conclude with a couple other points. I think for an agency that, as both other speakers have pointed out, is supposed to be data-driven, Exhibit A for where maybe that fell down, and now I will get hopefully some hackles from my co-panelists, is the network neutrality notice of proposed rulemaking. The notice talks about storm clouds gathering, words to that effect, with respect to the ability of ISPs to do certain things to block, control, or otherwise minimize the value of the Internet. But there really wasn't much data to launch the rulemaking. There were two instances, one involving a telecommunications carrier and therefore not really under the rules that be proposed, and second, the Comcast complaint, of which there's a lot of different versions, a little bit like watching either a Rashomon film or a train wreck, depending on your view of the Comcast or the FCC. So for a data-driven agency, in other words, you'd like to see some problems before the government starts regulating, because rule number one is you don't regulate in the absence of a problem. Our economy is based on a free market model, which says we let the market work. If there are market failures, then we consider regulation, but we only regulate. The administrative process kicks into gear if we're convinced that the regulation will actually do more good than harm with respect to the problem that you've identified and that you have a substantial basis for the for proceeding. So I think that the notice itself had some problems with respect to data-driven nature. There has been a lot of process, but in some ways we've missed some of the biggest elephants in the room, or the biggest problems. And let me give you two. One is the stimulus legislation. Congress, it's not a lot of money by CapEx standards, but $7.2 billion could have done a lot for broadband. I think the jury is definitely out as to whether the country is really benefiting from that, either in terms of adoption, in terms of greater awareness of how to use the Internet, and many of the things that would cause the rates of use to go up. And the second was the digital transition. It's true Congress ordered it, but this digital transition will come back to haunt our communications policy for years. Think about it. We had broadcasters spending all this money, all this customer dislocation, and maybe 10 to 15% of the country actually getting any use out of a digital transition, everybody else taking it from pay TV. Wouldn't it have been smarter to rethink this whole thing, take a look at the spectrum that's desperately needed for other uses, or at least arguably desperately needed, and not have the digital transition that we had? But in fact, we went forward with both feet on the gas pedal, and the result is where we are now, which is essentially a broadcast system that doesn't really match up with the way people use television today. Let me stop there. Thanks.
Thank you. All right, so we have about 10 minutes for questions. We have two mics. We'd like to ask. Yes? Please walk up to the mic so that you'll be heard.
They never got that.
Okay, can you hear me?
Uh-huh.
Okay, I know you touched on it a little bit, but I was wondering, with all of the new changes in the FCC, if there's any that are directed at diversity licensing or leasing issues. I know that for a lot of groups that were advocating for more minority ownership, that cross-ownership and those types of rules they felt worked against their cause. And do you see any changes or anything addressing those issues as the FCC moves forward?
Good question, Angela.
Yeah. I think we will see things that, that go to try to address some of those issues. The FCC has brought Mark Lloyd on to be an overall diversity coordinator for the FCC and its various initiatives. There is a fair amount of focus on that in broadcasting, where because of the way in which we regulate and kind of the judicial authority for regulation over spectrum is more, which include the broadcasting licenses, is stronger than it is over cable or other media. So I do expect to see emphasis on that. I do think that there is genuine interest in that. There has been a fair amount of activity around tribal issues, especially around tribal access to spectrum and telecommunications. And I would also fully expect that a portion of the National Broadband Plan will be addressing how broadband adoption and broadband policy should be expanded to ensure that people of color have access to these essential facilities.
Those of you who've been here for a few years know that Mark Lloyd joined us for the Red Lion Symposium 2 years ago. Does anybody else want to add to that?
I would just say the challenge, you have the Adiran decision and the commission continually butting its head against the limitations of that. And I think the market is changing so dramatically. That's one of the biggest things. I mean, radio is still a very good business, but it's not the business it was 10 years ago. And creating a tax certificate policy, which I think most people would say is one way to get more minorities in by discounting the price of things through tax certificates to the sellers to qualified minority entities. These businesses, the price of media properties is a real question mark, because nobody really knows if you want to own a radio station 10 years from now, or whether the internet and satellite radio is going to so diminish, and the MP3 player in the car is so going to diminish the value of those things. And certainly the same is true for television. So then you're left to very large properties like cable systems or satellite, and those the tax certificate policies that would be so, the economic gain to the seller would be so great. So we need to think of new ways to get at that, because it's obvious watching television that it's not, or and television generally, is that it, we still have many of the same problems we had back when the Kerner Commission raised the relationship between representations in the media and social problems that we have.
John, do you have a question?
Well, speaking of Red Line and the fairness doctrine, the only references that I heard to it were somewhat joking, that it's something that is not going to actually happen. When Obama first came into office, it was appeared to be on the wish list of a lot of people who were big progressive supporters of the Obama administration, that this is now the time to bring back the fairness doctrine. Two questions. Is the fairness doctrine actually dead as a result of the fact that they don't want to get into the politically contentious issues? And second, is it going to come up in sort of different forms in other contexts, like the whole NBC Comcast merger, that you know, yes, there may be 500 channels, but if they're all owned by the same group of companies, that may not be such a good thing for the public market?
Well, let me say a couple of things about that. One is that for those who are not familiar with it, the Fairness Doctrine was a regulation that was imposed by the FCC on broadcasters, so radio and broadcast television, that if you presented one point of view, you had to present the opposing point of view. And it contained a second part that said you also had to do stories that were of local significance and importance. So there were kind of two aspects to that. The FCC abolished the fairness doctrine in the mid-80s. It has been a subject of some debate how the overwhelming conservative nature of talk radio, whether that is attributable to the elimination of the fairness doctrine, whether it would be a good idea to bring the fairness doctrine back as a means of introducing other voices into that debate, or whether that would be harmful. I think that we are not likely to see an effort to revive the fairness doctrine in the way it existed prior to when the FCC eliminated it. I do think that particularly in the wake of Citizens United, where the question is, what do you do about the fact that you can now sell, you know, the corporations can directly buy however much ad time they want and use it with regard to, you know, and can campaign directly against candidates and so forth, that there will certainly be a renewed interest in the question of, for political discourse, how do you level the playing field around advertising? And it would not surprise me if, particularly as we see how this election season shapes up, whether there is a renewed interest in things like free airtime or in beefing up the identification, political advertising identification rules, or other things that you can do with the somewhat broader authority you have traditionally had to regulate in the broadcast license area to address what is perceived at the moment to be much more the issue of corporate influence through the purchase of advertising time. But I'm not sure that we're going to see an effort to try to make sure that there is a progressive voice on the air that counterbalances the Rush Limbaughs of the world.
Chris, does Free Press have a position on the Fairness Doctrine's revival?
We generally try to stay clear of the issue, mm-hmm. frankly. It is a very sensitive time. There are a lot of important goals that the Fairness Doctrine set out to achieve. Whether that is the right vehicle for achieving them, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I think that there are a lot of other media policy venues in which we would certainly take those goals into account, but the specific policies that the Fairness Doctrine represented, I don't know.
Yeah. On that note, we should end, since we're already a little late. So please join me in thanking Dan Brenner, Harold Feld, and Chris Riley for a great discussion. We're going to take about a